Hello, welcome. I would like to call the Task Force on Online Learning to order. Today is Wednesday, September 2nd. It's 10 o'clock a.m. Senator Devlin, who is the co-chair of this task force, will be a few minutes late, because, as will our other Senate colleagues, because Senator Edwards is being sworn in right now in the Senate chamber. So first, I would just like to thank all of you for agreeing to devote your time and energy and attention and research and thought to this very important issue. And I look forward to getting to know each of you better in the months to come. And it is my hope that the work that we are able to do together will help us to build some common ground around an issue that's very important to many folks in the state of Oregon. For those of you that are in the audience, these meetings will be publicly posted along with the agendas, and they are always open to the public, and I'm glad to see all of you here, and you are certainly welcome to continue to attend all of these meetings. We were going to move directly after the adoption of the task force rules into introductions and an overview of the work plan, but I'd like to wait for Senator Devlin to do that. So I think we're going to start with the adoption of the task force rules, which I believe were sent to everyone ahead of time, so hopefully you've had a chance to review those, and then we'll move directly into the overview of the Senate bill. So Representative Huffman, do you have a motion on...
Madam Co-Chair, I move that we adopt the proposed task force rules.
Second.
And one of the funny things about the legislature, and it took a while for me to get used to this, we don't have to have a second, but it's always good to have one. But Representative Huffman has moved to adopt the proposed task force rules. Is there any discussion? No? Is there further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, and a majority vote is required for passage of these rules.
Courtney Vanderstick?
Aye.
Just come around to the
front. Gary Temple?
Aye.
Nikki Squire?
Aye.
Kathleen Scalise?
Aye.
Bobby Reagan?
Aye.
Krista Parent?
Aye.
Brad Lynn?
Aye.
Mark Horning?
Aye.
Cindy Hunt?
Aye.
Larry Glaze?
Aye.
Dennis Dempsey?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Excuse?
Senator Bonamici?
Senator Bonamici, we're adopting the rules.
All right. And my place is...
Somewhere over here.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Devlin?
Excuse?
Co-Chair Gelson?
Aye. So having the...
I vote aye.
And Senator Bonamici votes aye as well. The motion passes and the rules are adopted. I also wanted to make sure that people knew Kathleen Scalise and Krista Parent are on the phone, so there are two other folks here with us that you can't visibly see at the dais. And we're going to move on into an overview of Senate Bill 767 from Dana Richardson, who is our wonderful, very talented task force administrator.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So for the record, my name is Dana Richardson, and even though we haven't done introductions, I'll be the administrator, and you've already gotten lots of emails from me, so I'll apologize in advance for the volume of those. So obviously our authorizing bill for this whole get-together is Senate Bill 767, so I thought we'd just quickly go through what's in there. There are basically kind of four parts to it. There were additional requirements that were added for virtual schools. There were provisions dealing with enrollment at virtual schools. There's one additional general provision you should be aware of, and then there's the part talking about us and what we're supposed to be doing. So just a key definition at the outset is the virtual public charter school. What is it within the legislation? It's a public charter school that provides online courses. It does not include a public charter school that serves students primarily in a physical location. So that's the language of the bill. So the additional requirements for virtual schools, there's quite a few. These are abbreviated to look at the full text of them. They are in the bill, but I think it was an important part of what was accomplished in Senate Bill 767, so I think it's worth noting. Additional requirements for sound financial management systems, itemized budgets and business plans and governance plans, employment of only highly qualified licensed teachers. The schools have to put together plans or performance criteria for student learning and academic performance goals, plans to involve parents and guardians as well as professional employees at the schools. There were a couple technology-related requirements that they use interactive internet-based platforms. and that students have access to computer and printer equipment and internet service cost reimbursement, which kind of goes to some of the equity issues we'll be talking about here. And then there were some requirements for contact with students. Educational events are required at least 6 times a year. Biweekly meetings with teachers are required, and those can be done in person or electronically or by whatever means are appropriate. And then the face-to-face meetings with teachers at least 6 times a year. So those are somewhat abbreviated, but I hope they give you a sense of some of the additional requirements. The enrollment provisions. So I should just quickly tell you what the 50% rule is in case anybody is not familiar with it. It's currently in statute, and it says that if a public charter school offers any online courses as part of its curriculum, then 50% or more of the students who attend the public charter school must reside in the school district in which the public charter school is located. So that's the 50% rule, and that's on the books right now.
Dana, can I briefly interrupt you? I forgot to make one statement, and I'm hearing in the buzzing. It's very important if you have a cell phone with you that you turn it all the way off. It interrupts the sound system, and if you hear that buzzing, that's because someone's cell phone is on silent and receiving a phone call. So please turn it all the way to off, not just to silent or vibrate. Thank you. Sorry for the interruption.
No problem. So with regard to the enrollment provisions, it applies the 50% residency requirement to all public charter schools unless they have a waiver that's granted by the State Board of Education and they're complying with the terms of that waiver. It also prohibits the State Board of Education from granting additional waivers to the 50% requirement and revokes any waivers that were granted since April 27th of this year. It prohibits virtual schools from increasing their enrollment as of May 1st, 2009, unless they meet the 50% requirement or they have a waiver and they comply with it. However, they can add siblings of current students. A couple more things that allow schools to increase enrollment. A virtual school with 120 or fewer students can increase the number of students if they receive a waiver from the State Board. And that's a notwithstanding what we said about not being able to do waivers, you can if. It also says that if there's a charter that was approved but didn't have any students when we passed this, they too could increase their enrollment in accordance with the 50% requirement. So those are some of the really fun enrollment provisions that were in the bill. There's just one additional general provision that you should be aware of, and it states that a for-profit entity is generally prohibited from being the employer of charter school employees if the virtual school sponsor contracts with a for-profit entity. So the idea here was that they would be employed by a public entity. There is an exception to that if there's an existing contract, so that they wouldn't have to, we can't authorize districts to break contracts. So those would continue but could not be renewed. And then we get to the task force. By statute, there are 17 members appointed by the speaker and the president. And there are two things that we're supposed to do. We're supposed to prepare a report and prepare any necessary legislation based on the report. So that sounds pretty easy, right? Well, the next 5 slides are what's supposed to be in the report. So let's go to that. The report should include for charter schools to offer online instruction. We should touch on methods of financing charter schools, levels of funding, financial accountability, and the appropriate sponsorship for charter schools that offer online instruction. We should talk about reporting student outcomes and compliance with academic accountability standards, as well as use of teachers who are licensed, appropriate teaching standards, and what the right amount of contact is between students and teachers. We want to talk about the grades and ages that should be served, the class sizes of online courses, including the student-to-teacher ratio, how to best serve students learning English as a second language, accessibility of online instruction and accommodations of students, and examples of school policies that include harassment, intimidation, and bullying. Just a couple more. We should include curriculum descriptions and accreditation or certification of online instruction, the method of authoring online instruction through school districts and ESDs, how to transition students who are currently enrolled in schools that offer online instruction to alternative learning if necessary, and then, of course, the catch-all, any other topics that we deem should be included. And I don't want to get too far ahead of the co-chairs, but I know there's interest in including a specific discussion of how special education students are served and whether or not there should be requirements for student attendance, how we monitor that in the online setting. We're required to have 4 meeting dates, and you've been apprised of those. We're going to talk a little bit more about the work plan in a minute, but you've got those already, hopefully, on your calendar. And we're planning to report our recommendations to the education committees no later than December 15th, so we're shooting for the November 19th, which is when those committees are scheduled to meet. And that ends my presentation. If there are any questions, I'm happy to take them.
Thank you, Dana. Are there questions for our committee administrator? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you very much. Senator Devlin, welcome. And Senator Bonamici, welcome to the task force. We jumped ahead to the overview.
Senator Morris will be here shortly.
Okay. Wonderful. We decided to skip the introductions until we had most of our folks here. We moved down to the overview, so we'll bounce back up to introductions. And I think for this, we'll just go through the room. You know, we have questions that each of you will address in the afternoon part of the meeting. But if you could just tell us a little bit about who you are, where you live, and the seat that you were asked to represent, what perspective you come from, whether you are State Board of Education, higher education legislator, that would be very helpful. And we can start at the other end with Mr. Glaze.
I'm Larry Glaze. I'm the superintendent of LeGrand Public Schools. This is my 35th year in Oregon Public School Education, second year as superintendent of LeGrand Schools. I've been in school districts primarily in Eastern Oregon, but I spent 4 years in Jervis School District nearby as a superintendent. I'm here as in the chair of school districts that are impacted by online charter schools, and that's my representation. I'm glad to be here representing Eastern Oregon and the unique issues that we have before us.
Thank you very much. Please.
My name is Mark Horning. I'm a board member of the Oregon Virtual Academy, and that's the constituency I fill here. I think the reason the ORVO was interested in me was I've been through most of the types of educational models in school, online, community colleges, four-year colleges, graduate colleges, military instruction, the various methods of language learning, and I was, I guess, considered a viable option for that reason.
Well, welcome. Thank you for coming. Representative Dembro.
Thank you. I'm Michael Dembro. I'm state representative for House District 45, which is northeast Portland out to Park Rose. And in my day job, I'm a faculty member at Portland Community College, where I've been involved for many years in discussion of online education, use a lot of online teaching myself, and this is an issue of great interest to me, one that I first became directly involved with when I was the community college faculty advisor on the State Board of Education for a couple of years, and I'm really pleased to be on this this task force, and I'm looking forward to the work that we're going to do.
Thank you. And on the phone, we have Krista Parent. And for those on the phone, are you able to hear okay?
Yes, it's great.
Great. So, Krista.
I'm Krista Parent. I'm the South Plains School District Superintendent, which is in Cottage, Oregon. I'm just beginning my 26th year of the district, and I am representing K-12 administrators in Oregon.
Great. Welcome. Thank you. Representative Huffman.
John Huffman, State Representative for District 59, which is Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, most of Grant, Jefferson County, parts of Deschutes, Clackamas, and Marion counties. And I've been on the House Education Committee for the last 2 years. And I am the representative for the super minority in the House.
Thank you, Representative Huffman. Please.
Dennis Dempsey, Superintendent High Desert ESD. Sir, I'm here representing the ESDs. I've been involved with technology and education for over 30-some years, and I've actually designed and taught online classes at the graduate level. So I have a very big interest not only in this, but on how we're going to provide the connectivity to provide all this to all the schools in the state.
Mm. Thank you. Ms. Squires.
I'm Nikki Squire. I am representing the State Board of Education on this group. As many of you know, the State Board spent a good deal of time over the last 2 years because of some responsibilities that the legislature gave us in 2007, looking into online schooling and issues. So I have a great interest in this topic as well. I live in Bend. Our family has a business, a ranch, in Sherman County, where my grandchildren go to school. I grew up in rural Harney County, but worked in school districts in the Portland area for most of my career. So I hope that I can bring some sense of some of the differences in various geographic areas in the state to the conversation as well.
Thank you. And on the phone we have, we'll go down to this other end, Kathleen Scalise, who is on the phone.
Yeah, hi everybody. Yeah, I'm Kathleen and I'm an assistant professor at the University of Oregon in Eugene. And I do research in adaptive e-learning. So these are e-learning products and tools for teachers and so forth that support differentiated instruction. And I work at multiple grade levels in K-12 and higher ed.
Thank you. Welcome. Cindy.
Hi, I'm Cindy Hunt. I'm here on the task force representing the Department of Education. I've worked at the department for 2 years, and in that role, I worked extensively with the State Board of Education as they were wrestling with the virtual charter school issues. I also work on other legal issues regarding education. See, before that, I worked for the legislature, and so I've been working in the area with public charter schools since 1994. Is when I first learned about charter schools, so a long time. Originally, I'm from rural Montana, so I actually have a rural background, and I think a lot of people don't know that necessarily. And I'm kind of excited to be on the task force. I know we have a big charge, though, ahead of us. So.
Thank you. Please.
My name is Brad Lynn, and this is my 10th year in education. I'm a licensed administrator who is serving as principal of the Clackamas Webb Academy. And my position, I think, on this board is to represent charter schools in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. Excuse me, Co-Chair Gelser. I'm Suzanne Bonamici, and I represent Senate District 17, which is in northwest Portland and Beaverton, Washington County area. I served in the House in 2007 and in 2009 on the Senate Education Committee. So I listened to a lot of information during all the testimony about the Senate bill that created this task force, and was appointed to serve on the task force, and I'm looking forward to the work ahead. I spent several years before joining the legislature as a public school volunteer and advocate, got very involved in school funding issues, and I'm very interested in the work ahead of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Courtney Vandersteck. I'm with the Oregon Education Association, and I'm the public employee representative on the committee. I've been in Oregon for 12 years, but I have over 35 years in public education, both as a teacher and working for the association. OEA's mission is to guarantee quality public education for all students in Oregon. We see charter schools and online learning as viable options, but we are continually concerned about financial stability for our state, and so we want to make sure that in addition to equity and access issues, we also look at the financial stability so that we can provide quality public education for every student.
Thank you. Gary.
Gary Temple. I'm the superintendent of Scio School District. Started in Scio in 1984. Would have been perfectly comfortable retiring as a teacher there. However, my board had different plans, and so later became the high school principal. Did that for 6 years and been the superintendent. This is my fifth year as that. And we sponsor Oregon Connections Academy, which is partially why we're all here, so I thank you for coming. And I am representing administrators who have online charter schools. So,
thank you. And Senator Morse will be joining us soon. In the meantime, Bobby Regan.
Hi, I'm Bobby Regan, and I am on the Portland School Board. I've been on since 2003, and I'm also the chair of the board's charter subcommittee. We have had 30 applications for charter schools that have come through our district. As of this year, we'll have 9 charter schools operating. two state-run and seven district-sponsored charter schools. I am here representing the Oregon School Board Association and school board members across the state from large districts and small.
Thank you very much. And Co-Chair Devlin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gelzer. I'm Senator Richard Devlin. I represent Senate District 19. That includes all of the people within Lake Oswego, West Lynn, Tualatin, the Stafford Basin, Lower Southwest Portland, if you know where it is, to Texas, off of McAdam. I've been in the legislature 13 years. I've been an advocate for K-12 funding since my son was in the third grade. He is now 26 years old. I'm very much looking forward to the work of this task force. I actually believe we can do some very good things here. I'm hoping that we can actually resolve some issues in a manner that all the parties that have some interest in this task force will be satisfied with the work that's done by this group.
Thank you. And Senator Morse, we're just doing brief introductions.
Oh, well, thank you.
It's your turn.
thank you. I'm not sure what the nature of the discussion has been, but
briefly,
I
briefly who you are, where you
okay,
represent.
Okay, District 8, yeah. Which is the Albany, Corvallis area of Linn and Benton counties. My background has been in the world of business. I was president of a family-owned business in construction materials, and our trade area was Western Oregon. Was invited to run and have served now. This is approaching the end of the second term in the Senate. I've been on revenue and education and ways and means and a variety of experiences and task forces, and thank you very much. That's probably more than you ever wanted to know.
Thank you for agreeing to serve. And Dana, could you briefly introduce Ian?
I won't reintroduce myself. I'm Dana, but I want everyone to know that Ian Tolleson is the committee assistant, and he is the right-hand person behind the scenes with me getting everything done. So thank you.
Thank you. And I am Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from House District 16, which is half of Senator Morse's district, and that includes Corvallis and Philomath and two people that live in Linn County, but mostly it's a Benton County thing. It's the land of the Oregon State Beavers. Go Beavs. I am the chair of the Education Committee and look forward, as Senator Devlin mentioned before, to the work of this committee, and it's my hope that we can work together in a collaborative kind of a way to find some common ground around a value that I think we all share, which is a desire to serve the students of the state of Oregon and make sure that every student in the state has access to a high-quality public education in a way that serves them best. So thank you all very much for coming today. The rest of our schedule this morning, we are going to move on. We're going to have an overview of national online learning issues. As you may have read over the lunch break, after you pick up your lunch, we're going to head upstairs, and there will be demos available from six different online providers, so the task force members can have the opportunity to physically manipulate and see what these different platforms are, and it's our hope that that can help to inform our work and give us all a greater sense of what it is that we're working on. So with that, I'd like to invite Susan Patrick, who is with the International Association for K-12 Online Learning, to come to the dais and maybe give us a brief introduction of yourself and an overview of national online learning issues. If you have questions as the presentation goes on, do you prefer during the presentation or at the end?
Either way.
So if you can hold them till the end, generally that helps us maintain the time frame better. But if you have a burning question that you can't move on, just go ahead and raise your hand and we'll take it right then. So thank you and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the task force. It is an honor to be here. For the record, my name is Susan Patrick. I'm the president and CEO for the International Association for K-12 Online Learning, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan 501c3 based in the Washington, D.C. area, and I can't tell you how happy I am to be out of the Washington, D.C. area and in the great state of Oregon. Every time I've been in Oregon, the weather has been like this, so I have never seen it rain here. It's very beautiful. There's a quote from
about 48 hours.
quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson that says, nature wears the color of the spirit, and it's lovely to have this weather and visibility flying in yesterday to be able to see Mount Hood and the surrounding mountains. I'm the former director at the U.S. Department of Education of the Office of Educational Technology, and I was there. I was a direct report to the Secretary of Education and was over all of the technology programs for both higher ed and K-12. I had access to the most cutting-edge research and researchers in the field of education and education technology, and visited 48 of the 50 states. I continue to travel almost every week, which in some ways is good, again, to get out of Washington and see what's really happening in the field. But it also provides an interesting perspective. I think it's important to know a little bit about background. I worked in Arizona as a legislative liaison on technology issues with Governor Hall when Janet Napolitano was the Attorney General there on a number of issues, and really look at ways technology can be effective in government, in education, and in expanding access, and also the challenges that go with that. When I was at the Department of Ed, I also served on the Secretary's Rural Education Task Force with members of Congress, members of the House and the Senate, and we looked at different ways to address and achieve some promising practices for districts in rural America. Certainly the challenges are great. So just to note on the development of the National Ed Tech Plan, one of the other things that happened is we had ministries of education from all over the world come through, most of which wanted to come through our office and talk about what's happening in terms of technology in the U.S. and internationally. And that's where things get really interesting. And so I'm going to provide a national overview of issues in online learning and virtual schools. The reason I left the department to go work for a nonprofit is there is so much potential here to really change what we can do for kids. And every morning when I get up, my whole reason for doing everything that I do is to say, can every kid in America have access to a world-class education? Can every kid in America have access to the very best resources and the very best teachers? And when you start framing things that way, you see that whether you work in an environment, in a state, in a district, at the national level in D.C., there are very few people that are there just making decisions based on what's best for the kids. And at every event that we do, we bring a student panel together of students that are learning both through supplemental programs and full-time programs online, and allow everybody in the audience to ask as many questions to those kids as they want. And that is the most powerful, really the most powerful, to say that the students that choose to take online courses and choose online learning are doing so for a whole variety of reasons. The national studies that are out there that have been done by the Sloan Consortium, by the U.S. Department of Education and others, show that the number one reason that students take online courses is to meet the individual needs of students. That's a pretty good reason. The number two reason is that the courses are otherwise unavailable for them. 40% of high schools in the United States do not offer advanced placement courses. A lot of those high schools are in rural America, in rural areas. When you're dealing with the kinds of issues, shortages of math and science teachers, so I'll give you an example. In the state of Georgia, there are 440 high schools. How many licensed physics teachers teaching in the state of Georgia? 88. And those kinds of numbers and those kinds of gaps exist in every state. How are you going to address the needs of kids in an increasingly technologically advanced world, in a knowledge economy where kids are going to be competing globally? What does that look like, and how do we do it? And how do we at least give kids the choices that they need to be able to access the best education available? So the two centerpieces for writing the National Education Technology Plan ended up being, for the first time ever, that the federal government had ever looked at students and student demographics. What are students doing with technology inside and outside of school? And we know that these students are using technology in their everyday lives. Students from low-income families that don't have access to computers in their homes are finding ways to access them, whether it's through the library, through the school, through going to friends' houses, going to relatives' houses. They are getting online. They're finding ways to do that. But the big gap is, are we teaching kids how to study, how to be academically appropriate online, how to write, use correct grammar, do all of these things? And these are the types of things and skills that, along with increasing access to courses, highly qualified teachers through virtual schools, is students are getting instruction in a very different pedagogy for being more interactive with other students, with teachers, and the results, and I'll go through some of the research. 2 months ago, the U.S. Department of Education released the results of a study. They reviewed from the last 10 years all studies that followed either an experimental design or a quasi-experimental design, the gold standards of research on K-12 online learning. And I don't know if you saw the press release, but do you know what the study found? Based on student achievement and student performance, students taking online courses performed better than their counterparts in traditional face-to-face environments. All of the research points to as good or better, and more of the research in the last 3 years is showing, with the growth of online learning and the enhanced professional development that teachers are getting to teach online, with the new tools of interaction, the ability to meet students exactly where they are and to dive deep into subjects, that whether it's AP course tests, the end of course exams, whether it's the core courses and the math and sciences end of course exams, based on fixed measures of student achievement, students in online learning are performing better. Let me go ahead and provide a little bit more of a national overview and where we've come. 10 years ago, the first programs were really starting in online learning in the U.S., and when our organization was founded just in 1993, Marty Carlin, who was here in Oregon, was one of the original pioneers in online learning. 10 years ago, Oregon was really seen as one of the leaders in the field, being thoughtful in how to provide online resources to students across the state. Other states are moving faster, though, and other states are doing more in terms of opening access to online learning for students. Right now, 34 out of 50 states have a statewide virtual school program, which means that they provide enrollments for students in online courses that are otherwise unavailable for them. And a number of other states are providing full-time opportunities statewide. States such as California offer full-time programs across the state. States such as Colorado have both a supplemental program and full-time opportunities. In a national ranking, Idaho ranked number 3 last year. They provide statewide full-time opportunities. Those full-time cyber charter schools have oversight from a statewide charter authorizing board that do the quality and accountability for the state, as well as a very strong state supplemental program working with districts to provide online courses to students that just want to take one or two courses. They have a whole range. They have very good quality and accountability measures in place that mirror the kinds of quality that they're looking for in both online settings and face-to-face, based on student achievement and performance, as well as the quality indicators for running those programs. As I mentioned, I've been in 48 of the 50 states looking at all different models, and I can tell you no two of these state policies or state models are the same. It is very complicated, and I know that the work of this task force is going to be difficult in sifting through both the myths that are out there on online learning and also getting through all of the research that has just come out in the last 3 years in terms of showing what works in online learning and the promising practices. I provided a publication that we just put out through our research our research group, Evergreen Consultants writes the Keeping Pace with K-12 Online Learning every year, and that's an overview of all 50 states' policies and models. They just completed some work for us looking at funding and legislation models in all 50 states and pulled out what are promising practices. So excerpts from different state laws are highlighted throughout this guide and a framework for how you can provide high-quality opportunities so that every student can access online opportunities, but that states can develop frameworks that ask, and there's a list of 15 questions to help guide the work that you're doing. I think it's also important to note that people in education and people outside of education are taking a look at how virtual schools and online learning can really help develop solutions. And the nation's foremost expert in innovation and innovation studies, the author of The Innovator Solution, The Innovator's Dilemma, Clayton Christensen, who teaches at Harvard Business School, three years ago wrote a book that included Seeing What's Next, included a chapter on online learning in higher education and K-12, and then later, much to my surprise really, wrote an entire book on what is the most promising innovation in all of K-12 education. And the answer was online learning. What online learning is doing is before you can develop a course, you have to rethink every bit of curriculum and content that goes into that course. Before a teacher can go on teach online, they have to receive professional development and training in a whole new set, not only of technology tools, but skills and pedagogy that allows the students to interact, to go deeper. There's a heavier emphasis on writing and communication in these online courses. Susan Lowe's from Columbia University as a researcher has done studies of teachers that have been trained to teach online and those same teachers that teach face-to-face. And it shows that the teachers that are trained to teach online are taking those skills also into their face-to-face courses, and that it is improving teaching overall. So there are lots of different levers here in terms of what we call school reform and improving schools, increasing access, increasing and improving teacher effectiveness. When you look at the current focus on trying to increase and improve the distribution of highly qualified teachers, especially in areas such as math, science, foreign languages, that are increasingly important, you can't do that without high-quality online learning. So what does a world-class education look like? Let's take a step back. I know that when I ran a distance learning campus for Old Dominion University, I was familiar with our program and our policies and how working with our faculty and our students, but I didn't know necessarily what was going on in other universities or in other states or across the nation. And one thing that I'd like to do is not only provide an overview of what's happening in the U.S., 75% of school districts in the U.S. offer online courses to students. Many of those districts are in states with state virtual schools that help offer those courses. Many of those school districts are partnering with other providers to help get high quality, gold standard content and be able to either use the teachers from those online programs or train their own teachers. There are a variety of models, and districts are looking to see what works best for them across the board. Internationally, it's very interesting. So I met with all of these ministries. I've traveled to China with the Ministry of Education there, traveled to Mexico in 2004 with the Ministry of Education there when I was with the government. In Mexico, they provide every single teacher in their pre-service programs in universities with the training and skills to teach online and to use digital content. Since 2003, they have had their entire K-12 content and curriculum digitized. They provide that to every teacher. They provide every incoming teacher, every teacher with a laptop. This has been happening since 2004 in Mexico. They don't have the same internet connectivity we do here. They provide all of those resources on CDs, over the internet, in a variety of ways. When you walk into a classroom in Mexico, some of the facilities are not as nice as the classrooms here, but they are using sheets instead of like projector screens, and they're showing some of the most high quality content I've seen in the most selective public high schools like Thomas Jefferson in Fairfax County, Virginia. And they're working with their students in a way that far exceeds what you see in most classrooms in the United States today. When I was meeting with the Ministry of Education in China, I'll do a quick little tour around the world in just a couple minutes. So go down to our neighbors to the south in Mexico. Let's shift and go overseas over into the EU. Last fall, in the EU, and people familiar with the International Baccalaureate Program, of which are in many of the schools here in the U.S., the International Baccalaureate Program, or IB program, started a diploma program online. They are now working across 125 different countries, training master teachers to teach online. They've developed gold standard, highly interactive, collaborative courses for the IB program, and students that are enrolled in this program are interacting not only students in their own neighborhood or in their own school, but students from other countries, developing their second language fluency skills and communicating voice over IP in a variety of formats. Talking about what a world-class education looks like and how to prepare global citizens looks very different from what many of our school districts in the U.S. can offer compared to what's starting to happen in the EU. In the EU, we have 50 states with 50 different sets of standards here in the U.S., but in the EU, they have 45 different countries with completely different governance structures working together on the EU e-learning project, which is looking at how they move to a competency-based system from cradle to grave that follows K-12, higher ed, and into workforce, goes to any screen, allows a student, for example, in the 10th grade in, say, Ireland, who's studying trigonometry, to go in while they're riding a bus in any location on their cell phone, on their computer, on their mini device, to go in, do a virtual tour of the Louvre, go in front of the Mona Lisa. There may be students there in this virtual landscape from other schools, other parts, where they can go into chat rooms and discuss the Mona Lisa, or a lesson can pop up based on their trigonometry, where they are in their competency, give them an equation, show them how this works on the Mona Lisa. They can take an instant assessment. That information will go back to their teacher. It is a whole competency-based system that they're driving, pulling from museums, education, libraries. This is a very different world from the EUIB program. And the folks that were heading up that program said, Susan, we're developing this program to go across 125 different countries. They come to our virtual school symposium, our annual conference every year, and they said, what doesn't make sense in the U.S. is you've got 50 different states developing 50 different models for online learning, and you're reinventing the wheel every time. They said, I understand that's true, but we have to do it this way because this is the way that the governance is set up, and in some respects we do, but it doesn't make a lot of sense that everybody has to reinvent the best Algebra 1 course, the best calculus course, or the best physics course. However, that's what's happening across the U.S. So let's go over from the EU over to Turkey. 3 years ago, we had a new member from Turkey, Dr. Goyazdin. Dr. Goyazdin called me. He came to our annual conference. He looked at the way online learning is being implemented across the U.S. There's a lot to learn here, some really great models, and I'll give you a couple of really good state models in just a moment. So 3 years ago, Turkey had zero students taking online courses. Through a partnership between the government and private providers, they developed what they call gold standard online courses, trained master teachers to teach online. And in 3 years, how many students does Turkey have taking online courses? 15 million. In the United States, online learning has been around for the last 10 years. We have a very large growth rate at 30% annually. So back in 2000, there were about 50,000 students taking online courses. In 2002, there were about 320,000 students taking online courses. In 2005, there were about 500,000 students taking online courses. And last year, there were an estimated 1 million enrollments in online courses. Compare that with Turkey scaling up to 15 million kids in 3 years. It's not that we're moving so slow, but it's that other countries are moving so much faster across the board. So let's go from Turkey into India, where in the next 10 years they want to provide universal access to education. What India is doing is they are researching internationally benchmarked content standards. They're digitizing the content and curriculum based on those internationally benchmarked standards. They're training master teachers to teach online. If they were going to provide universal education to every student in India in the next 10 years, how many schools would they have to build? 200,000. They're not going to be able to do that. So virtual schools to them aren't this thing over here. They're a core way of providing education and a high-quality education to students that may not otherwise have access or to students that want those options. So the other interesting thing about India is that not only is that a core strategy in how they're going to scale up education, but the internationally benchmark, they see that as an export opportunity, as teacher shortages, not only in the U.S., worldwide, are going to be in a scale that we've never had before in the next 10 years. This is only going to get worse in terms of the teacher shortages before it gets better, and that's true in the U.S., where we have the average age of a teacher today is 47 years old, and we're expecting to lose a huge proportion of our teaching workforce in the next 5 years. So last stop is China. We met with the Ministry of Education in China. 5 years ago, they had digitized their entire K-12 content and curriculum. They've been working to train master teachers to teach online. You see a theme coming here. Now, China, we did an international survey in 2006, and China has plans to use online learning and online programs to scale up education to students that don't have access. In the next 10 years, their goal is to reach how many students that don't have access to high-quality education? 100 million more students that don't have access in the next 10 years. You say, how is China going to do this with their internet access, right? Well, they're waiting until the 4G technologies, I mean, ever heard of WiMAX, the WiMAX technologies, the 4G technologies to come out. China does not have the FCC and all of these telecom rules that we have in the U.S. for better or for worse. They can do what they need to do to go enhance rural connectivity. So when these new WiMAX 4G high-speed wireless broadband technologies with a radius of 30 miles come out, and when are they due to come out? At the end of 2009-2010, they're going to go prime time. When this happens, they have teachers scaled up to teach online the digital content, and what they do, think about what they did for the Olympics. What they're planning on doing as a central part of their education strategy on online learning is going to be phenomenal. And so as I've gone around to these other countries, I try to think, well, how, when I come back to the U.S., when we're fighting all of these, let's say fighting, it's just the nature of having 15,000 school districts in 50 different states, and every state having a different school finance policy and different rules related to seat time and line of sight, and all of these things that when you ask the question, what can we do for kids? How can we ensure that every kid has options and opportunities for either part-time or full-time online learning? How can every kid have access to what we know looks like a world-class education today? The answer is, we can make it happen through online learning. It's possible, we can do it. But getting past some of the barriers, a lot of them are unintended. A lot of barriers are old policies that were put in place maybe even 10, 20 years ago that restrict access to students based on geography, that have enrollment caps or limits on what kids can do. And we're trying to put together positive policy frameworks, and we've released in the last 2 years, national quality standards. We're working with 3 of the 6 regional accreditation agencies. From the work that I did at the Department of Ed and others, we've done a literature review of quality standards for online courses and for online teaching. Online teaching that includes a rubric for evaluating effective online teachers. These are being used in states all across the U.S. We are getting ready to release in the next month quality standards for online programs that will be adopted by a number of the accreditation agencies. So there are good frameworks out there for evaluation of online programs. In the last year, the U.S. Department of Education released a guide to evaluating online programs. Online programs generally fall into 3 main buckets or areas. One is online resources, and those are repositories of online resources. So an example of that in Oregon would be what's called the virtual school district. The Oregon Virtual School District is really a repository of online courses or online resources, but you don't have enrollments or instructors that are being trained that are through that program that are processing registrations and delivering courses anywhere. So you've got resources. And then, by definition, online courses that are instructor-led are generally, when I'm talking about state virtual schools, supplemental programs, or full-time virtual schools, we are talking about a highly qualified teacher, a licensed teacher, that is trained in teaching in an online course. And online programs can span across those 2 areas that you would call some online programs that are just licensing or buying or creating content to make that available. But we're really focused on how can every student have access to a highly qualified teacher, and how can every student access the kind of curriculum and courses that they need. Just by way of comparison, we're talking about that China example. In 1999, China had only 4 million internet connections. By 2006, China had 137 million internet connections. The next year, that essentially doubled. In 2007, 250 million internet connections. So when this 4G and WiMAX and wireless technology becomes available, those numbers are going to shift greatly. There was a report that just came out, and the U.S. is ranking internationally on broadband access. And the United States is now ranked number 26 worldwide in broadband access. This is a huge problem. We participated in some hearings at the FCC a few weeks ago. Online learning is a major driver and application for building out broadband to rural areas. It is a really important application, not only for K-12, but also for higher ed and expanding access. Many of these full-time virtual schools and programs, while they don't have transportation costs, the amount of investment in infrastructure and technology is helping to provide computers and internet connectivity to students that don't otherwise have access. And this is going to be more and more important as the digital divide in the U.S. gets greater. It also gets greater on a global scale. And like I said, it's not that we're moving so slow, we're trying, but it's that other countries and other places are moving so much faster that the rate and the scale of which adoption of innovations that work, that are happening around the world, that are fueled by technology and the new delivery system using the internet, and the ability for people to connect and collaborate and access experts and go so much deeper. You're not limited to one teacher with one textbook. Students look out the window. They know what's out there in the real world. They know how many more resources they want to have access to that. They want to have a relevant curriculum. They want to have opportunities that fit with the world that they live in. And things are just different for kids today. I mean, when I grew up, there were 3 channels on television. We had the rabbit ears, and to get the 3rd channel, I was in rural Tennessee, we had to put the tinfoil on and shake around the rabbit ears. And kids today are born into the age of the internet. You know, they've never seen a phone with a cord on it. It's just an entirely different world. But we need to give them academically appropriate. We need to give them academically appropriate work to do, and we need to provide them with the educational opportunities. Just real quickly, my last example is Singapore, and Singapore is a very structured country. But since the SARS outbreak in 2003-2004, Singapore now trains every single teacher in their pre-service programs to teach online. They have e-learning in 100% of their secondary schools, and in the recent issues with the swine flu and the H1N1 pandemic, they've been able to identify areas where there are outbreaks, shut down schools a day before school starts, and have continuity of learning. They've been practicing continuity of learning drills using what? Online learning. For the last 5 years. They hold e-learning week once a year where they physically shut schools down and the teachers continue to teach and the students continue to learn. I don't know if you saw last week, but we were involved in a press conference with Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan, where he talked about continuity of learning for U.S. schools and specifically how virtual schools are a solution. So I know I've provided you with a lot of information, and I can go through some specific examples of research and a few state examples quickly, and then I'll be happy to take some questions. I mentioned the research released from the U.S. Department of Education just a few months ago showing the effectiveness of K-12 online learning. There are a number of studies. Another study was released by University of Memphis this year looking at socialization, which is one of those myths in online learning that a computer screen is teaching a kid. We're talking about instructor-led courses and other courses, other children in those courses interacting. But the increased flexibility, what they're finding in the full-time virtual school students, is enabling them to participate in more activities outside of the quote-unquote school day. They have more flexibility, and using the same measure of socialization in this study showed that the virtual school students were as socialized and in many cases had higher levels of socialization skills. So this myth that the students are just isolated with a computer screen and they're not interacting with other people, with other students, and developing those skills. More research is coming out in these areas of effectiveness. When you look at AP scores from a number of online programs across the country, Florida Virtual School, Virtual High School, even APEX, a provider from Seattle that's in all 50 states, students that are taking the AP exams are scoring higher, and more of them are scoring a 3 or above than the national average for traditional school students. So this is an innovation that works. This is an innovation that kids should have the option to do if they're interested in doing. States like New Mexico started their online program 2 years ago as a K-20 initiative. So they've got pre-K, K-12, community colleges, and higher ed all around the table on their advisory board. And they're trying to do a very coordinated effort. And I think that's a good example and an interesting model, so that they have dual enrollment or concurrent enrollment programs, so students start earning college credit. At the same time, a lot of these programs started to provide advanced courses or courses that were otherwise unavailable, like math and science courses, but we're starting to see for students that are challenged or need remediation or are retaking courses, giving them new opportunities to interact and new models of delivery is also being successful. So we're seeing, even with the challenged students, there's a school in Cincinnati that's an alternative high school that has moved entirely to online learning and blended learning models that is having much better results than the other alternative high schools. So whether you're dealing with students that are, you know, gifted and talented and advanced, and yes, they should have access to more opportunities too, whether you're dealing with kids in core courses, whether you're dealing with struggling students. The key indicator, the key characteristic of online learning that seems to be working is not that one size fits all, but the ability to customize and personalize instruction. And the amount of data that a teacher or an instructor uses in the program to help them guide that personalized instruction is far greater than what kinds of information most traditional teachers have. The other interesting thing, and I'm going to shift to teachers, is that for the first time ever, teachers have new professional opportunities to both teach face-to-face or to teach online. The teachers are now starting to have opportunities that mirror the rest of the workforce to allow some telecommuting opportunities, to allow both full-time or part-time teaching opportunities online. We worked with the National Education Association, and the NEA released this guide at our annual conference, the Virtual School Symposium, 2 years ago. It's the Guide to Teaching Online Courses, and the NEA also has a guide to quality online courses, too. And working to find ways that we can better train teachers in online instruction and pre-service and in-service has been a really important movement in working with the National Education Association in how they've been approaching looking at online learning, and we have a very good relationship working with them. The other teacher issue that is often a myth is that because some of our newer teachers or younger teachers use technology in their daily lives, that these are the people that are drawn into virtual schools and online learning. The data, there's a study, a national study called Going Virtual. All of these studies that I'm mentioning are free on our website. All of our information is available. Going Virtual did a study of virtual schools across the country, and the average number of years of experience of a virtual school teacher is 7 years, and many teachers have more than 7 years experience. Clark County hires most of their teachers for their virtual school from retired teachers that for whatever reason left the field, they got burnout. They're coming back in, getting...
Clark County, Nevada, or Clark County, Washington?
Clark County, Nevada. Thank you. Las Vegas. They're finding that to overcome some of these teacher shortages, teachers that have retired or left the field are coming back wanting to get trained online. And teachers with 7 or more years of experience also might speak to why the results are so good in terms of the effectiveness. You've got teachers that know the content and curriculum, that are looking at new ways of connecting with students and new ways of reaching them. And when you talk to teachers that teach online, they will say, our biggest fear is that they're interacting so much with the students because the students are so comfortable online that we have to make sure that they're not getting overworked, right, working with the students and communicating all the time. So it's been really interesting to see just the level of experience and the quality of teachers that are teaching in these virtual schools, and also the amount of training and professional development that goes into training teachers to move into an online environment. I know you probably have lots of questions, but I think your neighbors in Idaho have done a really good job in setting up their program to include both part-time options for kids across the state as well as full-time options across the state. Colorado was an early adopter in full-time virtual schools. The state went through a major audit there a few years ago, and the audit was a really good process for them because what they found was out of all of the providers in the state, there was just one that had some major problems, and they had major problems, and they should have been flagged. My biggest nightmare is a low-quality virtual school program, because a headline like that will ruin it for all of the high-quality opportunities that are out there. So I can't stress enough the importance of quality and accountability on all education, but on online learning as well as our face-to-face schools don't use very, we don't have very good measures of quality for our face-to-face learning. We have a bigger challenge when we start looking at how do we ensure we're providing quality in every setting and that we're not putting, that we're measuring what matters for student learning. And so there are some good examples. And as you move forward in this task force, I know I won't be in Oregon every day. I wish I was here. I wish I could spend more time here. I'd be happy to serve as a resource and try to help point you in the right direction. A lot of the pieces in that funding and legislation guide do quote and give you resources from other state legislatures and other states that have addressed the quality and accountability issues. With that, I would just like to wrap up and point out that this really is about kids, and it is about the ability to provide a world-class education for every kid. And when we're looking at the world that we live in, it is a global society. There's an interesting finding from the World Future Society. A World Future Society is this group that looks at future trends internationally. They've been accurate in the last 15 years, 97% of the time, plus or minus 3 years in their predictions. And their latest set of predictions was the top 10 trends that were going to change life as we know it globally on the planet in the next 20 to 30 years. So this is not small time stuff. It's like the top 10. And of course, number one, and this is going to sound obvious to all of you in Oregon, you've been leaders in this area, but number one is alternative energy and looking at the environment. Number two is the desalination of water. When I was in China, I was asked by the ministry officials, are you worried about running out of water? And certainly when I was in Arizona or California, that's a big issue. In Virginia and in Maryland, people aren't really thinking that way. The only item on this top 10 list for the World Future Society that related to education was virtual education. Now, virtual education is going to change life as we know it globally in the next 20 to 30 years, meaning that it is fundamentally going to change what students have access to what we consider a world-class education or a high-quality education. And this is happening in every continent right now. And whatever we can do to help our kids state by state in the U.S., I stand ready to help and try to find ways that we can improve education and want to help you in your efforts on this task force. You have a big job ahead. So thank you very much. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. So I'm sure there are a lot of questions. Who wants to jump in first?
I will. Larry Glaze, LeGrand School District in Huron, Oregon, kind of a rural area. One of the areas that we have concerns about with charter school education and some of the things that we've been dealing with is special education and how that's handled online. You've looked at this from more of a global perspective. What are some very important considerations for us to look at and think about as we look at charter schools in this state as it approaches the whole area of special education and things that should be included in that program?
Thank you for that question. It's an excellent question, and at our conference we'll have many sessions related to addressing special education and students with special needs. We've released a publication through our research committee, which includes both higher education members, state, district, as well as full-time providers. The research committee has produced a guide called Access and Equity in Online Learning that is looking at policies related to special education. And I'll give you an example. In Ohio, which has lots of full-time virtual schools, one of the largest virtual schools in the state is called the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow. The person who started and is behind that program has only one daughter, and that one daughter is a special needs student. And the reason he started that school was because he went from school to school and just felt like her needs weren't being met. I actually started a full-time virtual school to specifically be focused on special needs students. And when I say every program is different from supplemental to full-time, every program needs to have policies in place, being very proactive about addressing special needs. The guidelines that are in that report are too long to kind of go through right now, but in essence, it gives you look at the framework and indicators that need to be in there. Our online programs are very aware and have worked with groups like CAST, which looks at assistive technologies. There are a number of assistive technologies that help meet the needs of special needs students in a variety of accommodations. So it is a very important issue. We have a number of resources that may be able to help this task force in looking at that in Oregon.
Well, I'd be interested in learning more about that. The situations that have been brought to my attention in our school district, especially in a couple of instances, I don't think have been handled all that well, and I think it's an area for a lot of difficulties to be incurred, quite frankly.
What we found 10 years ago is that a lot of programs were starting out without thinking about it, and we're trying to get programs from the ground up to be including those provisions and access and equity the whole way and making sure that they have solid policies in place for managing and handling it and that everyone is trained in knowing how to manage that too.
Representative Dimbra.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Susan, thank you very much for coming out here. I really appreciate the international perspective, you know, as well as the national, you know, what you're telling us, and you just have given us so much common sense, to my way of thinking, suggestions, particularly those that have to do with the need to do much more training of teachers in online education. I think there's really a need for our schools of education to step up and incorporate this training in their curriculum. Well, one of the real challenges, I think, that we face in this conversation, that we're all going to be facing in this conversation, is the need to really to distinguish when we're talking about exclusively online settings, you know, as opposed to blending settings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we're looking at success data, you know, for example, to look at, you know, when we're talking about schools that are perhaps using a course or two, you know, to supplement their face-to-face instruction, as opposed to those that are exclusively online, and also to distinguish between K-12 from higher ed and training programs.
Right.
You know, the report that you were talking about from the Office of Educational Technology, one of the things that really struck me in that was their point that there really have been very few studies. There haven't been enough studies in the K-12 setting. And they caution us to be really careful about looking at their results, where in many cases they're extrapolating from the other settings. Although they do feel prepared to make some recommendations and findings, one of which is that blended is more successful than exclusively online. And that really leads to my question for you, which is, why do you think that is, and what is there in the what can the online settings do to better approximate what the blended settings are able to do so that they can both incorporate the advantages of online education but still have the success that the face-to-face still has when it's blended?
Right. And I was on the technical working group over that research study, too. So in full disclosure, I'm intimately familiar with it. So not only did they find blended as even more successful, but they did find online more successful than the traditional. And they did note that there is a limited number of studies in K-12 online education because K-12 online education has only been around for the past 10 years. And There were several statewide studies which I was involved in funding and looking at the research when I was at the Department of Ed. One was a statewide study of Spanish, online Spanish in West Virginia, and another was a statewide study of Algebra 1 in Louisiana, and both of those studies were of the nature of rigor that they would include in this overview. There were more studies in higher ed and from workforce training that included the same kind of framework and rigor that they wanted to look at what are those characteristics and components to make them effective. But there is a limited number of K-12 online learning studies, but there are some, and they did look at the ones that do exist, and we're trying to push for more research. So why were the blended even more successful in the online, and maybe compare that to face-to-face too? And I'll point to page 6 in this report that we did on funding and legislation is interesting because it gives you the defining definitions, dimensions of online programs. And at the bottom is really what we're talking about here, fully online, blending online and face-to-face, and fully face-to-face. This also gives you an idea of how complex these different program models are, too. So the defining characteristic of blended is that generally the instruction is online 20 to 75% of the time, and these numbers aren't precise, but it gives you an idea. In blended learning environments, what we're seeing is that instructors that are fully trained to teach in a blended setting are doing what we call, quote, the best of both worlds. They're using the tools and the power and the resources of online courses and the online development, whether it's discussion boards, whether it's synchronous instruction that includes the chats. It allows for that kind of 15 kids raising their hand at one time and posting on discussion boards and responding to each other, whereas a face-to-face classroom, you can have one. You can do both of those things when you're in blended environments. So blended learning is very exciting for in terms of where the future of education is going, and I really think that that's the direction. There is still going to be a need for students that can access courses or programs or one options to have the fully online programs available to them. But the blended programs are marked by really three key characteristics. You can get more in-depth into them, but that is a very different pedagogical shift that's taking advantage of both. It is a very different shift in the content and the ability for students to access resources that go much, much deeper than what they're used to in a traditional online course with limited resources or paper-based resources. And the third is marked by a real shift towards competency-based, or we call performance-based, competency-based, where students can go at any pace, and even in a blended learning environment. And that goes back to your main point about this is so important that teachers learn these skills today. Every teacher, whether they're teaching in a classroom or in a blended environment or in a virtual school, really need to have these skills because we're in the 21st century now.
Thank you.
Great. Poppy Regan with the Oregon School Board Association. So I was also going to play off of Representative Dembro's comments. You made a pretty broad statement that students taking online perform better. And I was trying to understand what you meant by that. Are you talking about students who take a course online as part of their traditional schooling, students who are taking kind of a 50-50 mix, or students who are 100% online? And what does that statement mean? And then my second question has to do with, I really appreciated the information on what's happening internationally, but I also wanted to understand whether internationally the focus in terms of online is more on secondary and higher ed, or whether it's the whole continuum.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Both good questions. The statement, students learning online do better than face-to-face, is very broad. We break down the the effectiveness research. In there's a document on our website. I wish I had actually brought this with me today. That's a full literature review citing each of those studies focused on K-12 online learning. Some of the studies are focused on students taking one or two classes. Other studies are focused on full-time enrollment, so you can see the different range of literature that's out there. Because there are so many different program models, a lot more research needs to be done. We need to know why some students are performing better, what are the conditions and practices, what is the combination of asynchronous versus synchronous learning that's taking place. All of these are really important questions that need to be answered. What the research is showing us is the ability for students to be able to interact what they call one-on-one with the teacher. I mean, none of these teachers are just one-on-one with the student because they have other students too. But what's really marked in the differential is that students feel like they have a one-on-one relationship, that they're not sitting there in rows with 30 other students or 25 other students. They have a very interactive, personalized relationship with their teacher in these online courses, and whether they're taking one class or whether they're taking all of their coursework that way, that has been the single most important indicator across all of the research. The single most important element in any online course or any online program is the quality of the teacher. And you can have the greatest gold standard curriculum anywhere. If you don't have a really great teacher teaching those kids, it's just the same as face-to-face, right, when you have a great teacher in the room. The nice thing is about online learning is that you can change the teacher distribution using online delivery. And that is a really important strategy to think about moving forward in terms of helping kids have access to these teachers. The second part, when you talked about, your second question on international.
When you were giving us our international data, are most of those countries more focused on kind of secondary and higher ed online learning, or are they looking at the K-12 continuum?
They're looking at the entire continuum. I didn't mention South Korea has a full-time national virtual school across K-12 grades. In the Middle East, I didn't talk about the Middle East too, they're really looking at setting up very rigorous quality standards and inviting in a whole range of international partners and providers to be able to do that, and they're going to judge based on the quality of student learning and their program quality requirements. So there's some interesting models that are emerging internationally, but they are across the whole range of K-12 and certainly higher ed as well.
Thank you.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gelser. Thank you so much, Ms. Patrick, for your very comprehensive testimony. I certainly learned a lot. And I do have a couple of questions that follow on some of those previously asked. I'm glad you mentioned the study. I have no doubt from certainly the testimony that I listened to as a member of the Senate Education Committee about the bill that students who are participating in online learning have skills and can perform well. And Bobby asked the question about as good as or better and where that came from. My question is with regard to, and I'm trying to separate it out as Representative Dembro said, the full-time versus the supplemental or blended. For the full-time online students, you said that this is a Department of Education study, and so I trust that they factored in all the socioeconomic and percentage of special ed and that type of thing. But what I've struggled with, and I hope you can address, is a question that I asked in the Senate, is when you have a student in an elementary grade, that student has a learning coach, which is typically, it's my understanding, almost always a parent. I guess there's some that aren't a parent, but most of them are their parents. So that student has basically a full-time, one-on-one learning coach, typically a parent, who is obviously very involved in their education. So how much of the success is attributable to that versus attributable to the model of online learning? If you compared the students in the brick and and mortar schools who go home to a parent who's there, free, able to sit down with them, talk through their schoolwork, help them with their homework, answer questions. Is this success attributable to that part of the equation, or is it attributable to the online model? And then I also wanted to know how the equity issues, what's your thought on the equity issues? Because for the elementary grades in the full-time model, you have to have somebody home with the child. You can't leave an elementary school student studying by him or herself. So you have many families with either a single parent or both parents working. So you have equity issues about who could enroll in full-time online learning. So what's your thought on the equity issue that you really are limiting it to people who have a full-time parent at home? And then also the data about what is the success attributable? Thank you, and sorry, that was so long.
No. And before you get into the question, just a time check for the committee. We've got about 3 minutes left on this agenda item. Three more people in the queue that have questions. So both keeping the responses concise and the questions concise will help us get through the day.
I'll try to do better next. Thank you. That's a complex question, and I think it needs a lot of explanation around it. So the short answer is I don't think the factor or the characteristic of the learning coach has specifically been isolated in the research studies for me to say 70% of them say that that's what it's attributable to, right? That's an interesting factor to look at, and what we're seeing is that the point here and the framework that you'll have in this document too that lists 15 different points, and this is from across all of the U.S. on page 9. These are the first principles from across all of the states. When we're looking at access and equity, the first question is, does every student, or rephrase that, every family, have access to supplemental, part-time, or full-time learning opportunities? That's the first question, and making sure that the policies fit that. The number two question in terms of access and equity, if a family doesn't have one parent or access to a learning coach, then this may not be the option that they would choose. And my point is, really, when I wake up every morning to say, does every kid have access to a world-class education, let them choose that and let them make that decision. In terms of the access and equity issue, though, however, this is interesting. The Florida Tax Watch Group is the watchdog group for the legislature in Florida and looking at how public funds are spent. And they looked very deeply into the virtual school programs in Florida and found that four major findings: a higher proportion of underserved and minority students than even in the general population in Florida was being served. Number two, the outcomes-based approach, those students were scoring better on the No Child Left Behind test, the end-of-course exams, the AP test, and all of the data that was collected. It was number three, a better use of taxpayer dollars with proven results. And number four, a new model of accountability that all education should look at. So when we frame access and accountability, sometimes places like the District of Columbia get caught up in not offering online courses because they go, well, what if one kid in our class can't access this? Whereas other states are saying, we're figuring out how to make the access. Those issues are huge, but these programs are figuring it out. Make it available and let it be an option for kids so that they can make those decisions. And hopefully we'll see supplemental programs, we'll see full-time programs, and we'll see blended learning programs in all of our schools to help ensure that our kids are getting the best education that they can that's available today. Thank you.
Thank you. Temple.
Thank you. I think I can be quick. So access aside, so I get the whole it gives kids access. In the perfect world where kids had access to both online and regular instruction, they had every class they wanted available to them either place, is there a population that's better served
buy on? I mean, is there a special does it make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
That's served by online that isn't being served by brick and mortar, access aside?
So the quick answer to that is, if you look across the U.S. right now, there are 50 million students in K-12, across K-12 education, 50 million kids. The percent of students that are learning online is about 1% right now. So it's 1%. When we've done national studies, Gallup did a study, we did one with Harris Interactive Survey, and NetDay, which is now Project Tomorrow, does studies. 40% of high school students are interested in taking an online course, 40% of middle school students are interested in taking an online course, and around 30% of elementary school students are interested in online learning. But the numbers are really closer to 1 or 2% in seeing those options. Of the 1 million enrollments in K-12 online learning today, 90% of those are students in existing school districts and in existing schools taking one or two classes. So, like I said, the future is really going to be in blended learning, but also having these other options open and knowing that the policies just need to be updated so we're not restricting access for the students that are best served. There are some studies. We're doing a demographic study of student demographics in online programs, but what we're finding is that there's a good mix between underrepresented groups, between students that are at risk, students that are high-performing, and all in between. So every kid, every student has a different reason for wanting to enroll in these programs. Some of them include bullying and things like that, that they want to take a full-time online program. And that's why I keep going back to, let's just make sure we're giving every kid the option for access and look at ways that we can improve education overall in every setting.
Thank you, Ms. Vanderstick.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you very much for your presentation, and I appreciate the extensive background that you've given on learning opportunities. I think it's really important, going back to Representative Dembro's comments also, that it was even the Federal Education Department officials that said most of the studies examined in that meta-analysis dealt with college-level courses, and they cautioned people against generalizing that to K-12. So I think that importance of research that breaks the two out can't be reiterated enough. But I want to shift gears to funding. Many of your examples talked about international examples, and you listed several countries.
Mm-hmm.
The United States is interesting in its universal access to public education. It is, there is federal education money, but state by state and oftentimes district by district. So what are the pitfalls that you see in stability of funding around this, either totally online or blended systems?
That's a great question. So one of the big things that's happening, or big trends that's happening this year in particular with the economy downturn, is that we're having more interest. I was speaking from our annual conference where people from all over the country, 1,200, 1,500 people, coming together to look at all these different models of online learning, blended learning, full-time online learning, is we're having more interest than ever and getting calls every day from district superintendents saying, how do we find what works? And in the United States, we spend more money than any other country internationally per pupil except for Switzerland. We spend an annual $9,969 per pupil per year. That's a lot of money. And what happens is, if you look over the last 30 years, our education spending, when adjusted for inflation, goes up in a line like this, and our achievement is flat. So about 34% of all of our nation's third graders can read
proficiently at grade level, 34%. When you break that down by white students, African-American students, Latino students, you see those huge gaps. When we have a graduation rate in 4 years of 70% nationally, and when you start looking at urban areas, that number going to 50% graduation rates in this country, it's just we keep spending money on the same way of doing things, yielding the same results over 20 years. We have to start doing, looking at solutions that are having better results and that work for kids and engage students. So what we're seeing is a huge interest in programs that can help keep kids on track for graduation, can help them get caught up faster, looking at students from Chicago to Los Angeles to rural areas, looking at online learning solutions that give them options that work. And when we talk about fiscal stability, certainly states and school districts are looking at every single dollar and saying, is the way that we've been spending these dollars working? Our biggest expense is people. It's always people. It's true in the online programs. The biggest expense is always people. And that if you look and compare face-to-face and online instruction in the studies, and you show that online learning cost the same as face-to-face. Why? Because it's the people running the programs and it's paying the teachers to teach online. The technology infrastructure and to have really high quality content is not cheap. Course development is the single biggest startup cost of an online program. And so maintaining the quality of your content, maintaining the professional development, and training your teachers is a huge cost. So in terms of financial stability, I think what the Florida Tax Watch report points out, which is this is a better use of taxpayer dollars with better results, that we're hearing from states and superintendents and people across the U.S. saying, how do we maximize every dollar we spend rather than assuming that the way that things have been spent for the last 20 years? I mean, budgets don't really... It's tough when you've got 15,000 school districts in 50 different states, and the way things get tweaked mildly, making major changes in effects. And that's why even though the department chose to expand that study to higher ed because of the number of studies, there are a number of K-12 studies, and the effect sizes in those studies for them to publish that are real. The positive effects are real in the K-12 studies. So be careful not to dismiss that, and I think they were very thoughtful in pointing out the higher ed studies and also the K-12 studies, but we're seeing positive effects with the same amount of money. So we can do more and invest taxpayer money in ways that best serve students' needs. I hope that answered the question.
I don't think I stated it clearly enough, but I'll think about it and try again later.
All right. Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Yes. First of all, a very quick question, actually. The task force has been provided with the site to your 2008 PACE report, which came out in November 2008. And I've read that report, and there's a lot of insight within that report in terms of when does your 2009 come out? And could you give us an advance copy of it if it came out?
I might have an advance copy in my inbox right now. The Keeping Pace with K-12 Online Learning Report is released every year at our annual conference, which is November 15th in Austin, Texas this year. So that's the official release date.
We wouldn't circulate it.
It's a very useful, and maybe in the next version I will check with John Watson, who's the researcher on that report, and maybe if it's not shared, you might take a look at it because it's got some really great information in it.
Okay, we'll check with you.
Okay.
My other questions have mostly been answered, but I do have one I wanted to ask because it's just a nebulous sort of issue that's within the bill that is not particularly well defined. And it's going to be one of the things that the committee has to deal with. You clearly identified in all of your testimony the importance of a highly qualified teacher and a highly qualified teacher that was aware of the different types of methodology that you might use in online learning versus classroom learning. One of the things that asks us is what's the appropriate ratio. I actually can't give you an answer to that. I am not an educator by training, but I just go from my own experience. I mean, in brick and mortar, you know, a third grade teacher might, in a comfortable situation, only have 24 students. Uncomfortable situation might have 35. But I've known teachers who teach, you know, multiple periods per day that have 150 to 200 students in a brick and mortar environment. How do we address that issue? I mean, what does there have to be really in terms of teacher contact? Because I'm going on a little bit too long, Madam Chair, also, but I do have some members of the body who will go unidentified that somehow believe that all this is that somebody goes onto a computer and that this is all technology and that there is no live person to contact.
Right, we call that computer-based training. Yes. That is not what I'm talking about, instructor-led courses. So the short answer to that is, in the entire time that I was looking at the research from the National Ed Tech Plan to the studies that are done in face-to-face settings and in online settings, there is no research that's out there to support a number for a teacher-to-student ratio, so we don't even have that data from face-to-face settings, which makes that question very difficult to answer. What we do have, and we do have from a number of programs, is our evaluating online teachers. A key component of that is the contact that the teacher has with the students, and that is really an important area. I think I have this national quality standards for online teacher set up as a rubric, and in here several states are using this as an evaluation of online programs, but also of online teaching. The key piece is the teacher evaluation and the contact, and making sure that the data on the student-to-teacher contact, that there is lots of interaction, because across these different program models, there's just not the data on the ratio information, like I said, but on evaluating teachers for communication and what they're doing in terms of quality online teaching is, I think, in terms of what the task force is doing, maybe a good way to approach that. It's a very difficult question.
And I had a question to finish us off this morning that may touch a little bit, not completely, on where Ms. Vanderstick was. As you mentioned, there are all these school districts, all these states across the nation, and we're all structured very differently. And I may be overly optimistic, but I do believe that people that are involved in education, regardless of what perspective they come from, are in it because they care deeply about kids and about kids learning. But when the rubber hits the road and we get to implementation, we are boxed in by the realities of funding and the allocation of resources, and we constantly struggle with the question of how do we divide and distribute those resources among a whole variety of children, and whether we're looking at that in special education and talented and gifted programs and students who we call average, even though I think there's no such thing as an average kid anywhere, or we're looking at kids in bricks and mortar schools, kids in homeschools, kids in virtual schools. In Oregon, as we've had this conversation, it's bumped up, I think, against all of the questions that many people have around charter schools and how do charter schools interact with public schools, and the reality of Oregon's unique funding system where dollars follow students not from local districts but from the state.
And I think that this isn't just the case where it's a charter school and a public school, but in the school district that I came from, where I served on a school board, we had open enrollment across our districts, and a student could move from one public elementary school to another public elementary school, or one public high school to another public high school, just because their parents chose that, and it was great. But the challenge that we saw between the schools was the reality of the student leaving, in some cases, would mean that that school could no longer offer a chemistry section, or that elementary school would lose a day of PE because the budget margins were so tight. And I would imagine, from the perspective of that principal, the question is, how do I make sure that this student has their needs met, and at the same time, all of these other students that I'm responsible for also have their needs met? So I guess my question is, how have other states grappled with that distribution issue? And is Oregon unique in confronting the issue of online learning within this charter school model? Does everybody do it within charter schools? Or are there other ways that people are doing this that is that doesn't necessarily get caught up in the firestorm around charter schools?
That's a great question. And there are a couple of different really important points in there. Number one is that what we've seen work really well across the states was that, so take Wisconsin, for example, right? That have full-time charter schools. It had a challenge from language that had been in code for a long time around what is school, what is a school wall, and then we're trying to define the students that were in full-time online programs, if they were, in fact, learning in a home environment, that by definition the four walls around them were a school, therefore the fact that the teacher was remote was a problem, that in the school walls, whoever was there, right, they had a licensed teacher attached to them, but the teacher in the school walls in the home was not. So that language got updated and changed. But in the process of updating that law, Wisconsin did something very smart, which was the two legislators, which it was a bipartisan effort that led this effort, realized that it was important for them to have a real supplemental program as well as the full-time programs. And what happens is and we see this across the board, for rural schools that don't have enough students to take a particular AP course or a particular foreign language that they want to take, having both supplemental options, and so they put into the law the development of the supplemental program too, to help meet the needs both of those districts that were unable to offer some courses, as well as provide for those full-time opportunities for the students that had them. That's one of the things in the principles that I think is really important, and states are grappling with that more and more. Colorado has done a really good job after the audit and the Trujillo Commission in helping to support the Department of Ed in doing a better job in quality oversight and accountability of the full-time programs. But also the new state superintendent there is looking very seriously about how to improve their supplemental offerings. So in Oregon, you're in a similar situation, because while you have what's interestingly called the virtual school district, they are very good online resources or online courses, but those aren't instructor-led courses that are, if there's a district that doesn't have that course offered, that's not actually a place where they can go and register and take the online course. So models like Georgia and others that offer both full-time and part-time offerings are probably better models of that.
Right, thank you. So as you'll see, we have gone a little bit beyond the time on our agenda. Senator Devlin, would you be comfortable? We actually didn't review the work plan. Can we do that in the afternoon?
Yes.
Does that work?
We will not take more than about 3 minutes to do that.
Okay, that sounds good. I think folks are probably ready for a little bit of a change of pace. So we are going to break and go upstairs. On your agenda, it says to be back in this room by 1:30. Because we've gone over, we're going to push that to 1:45. If you go up to, what is the room?
It's hearing room 343.
343. We have set up different stations from six different programs, and I know there are many folks here to watch the proceedings. I would just ask that we make sure that the task force members have the priority and the access to be able to get through and see this material. You can pick up your lunch
upstairs, and for non-legislators, you have to pay. So Ian will be up there to collect money, as it were. And the hearing room 343 is in the main part of the building on the Senate side. So if you're wandering around, you see S's before the numbers, you've gone too far, come back towards the rotunda.
Thank you. And thank you for, that was a lot of information. I'm sure that there will be more questions and a lot of discussion. So thank you for coming. And I'm sorry we haven't been able to show you any rain. Usually we're really skilled at that.
And the hearing room will be locked if there's anything you want to leave here while we're upstairs.
Do I need to gavel or anything?
No, we want you recess.
So I'm going to, the online learning task force will go into recess.